Today, we're checking in on our friends, the banks. Here's what matters. Live from New York City, I'm Julia Herman, and this is Market Matters from New York Life Investments. In this podcast, we bring you the best insights from across the New York Life Investments platform, because we believe that by sharing perspectives and engaging with you, our listeners, we can all become better investors. Welcome, everyone. It's the week of April 29th, 2024. And today we have a very special treat, a conversation about banking sector health. Now, that doesn't necessarily sound like a treat to most people, but when you get to talk about banks with Mark Kehoe, it really is a pleasure. Now, we're not talking about banks today because there's a crisis, fortunately. We're talking about banks today because there was a near banking crisis just over a year ago. And ever since, the specter of bank fragility has hung over almost every conversation we've had about the economy. So we're doing a checkup on the health of the banks, particularly as all the expectations for economic growth and interest rate movements in the U.S. have been shifting. With that, I'd like to welcome Mark Kehoe, a portfolio manager and credit analyst at Mackay Shields. He's also an experienced alumni as a podcast guest here on Market Matters. Now, Mark, I'd like to structure today's conversation on a simple timeline: where we were, where we are, and where we're going when it comes to U.S. banking. By where we were, I'm referring to that near crisis in March 2023, in which several smaller banks succumbed to liquidity management issues. And back then, Mark, we called you onto the podcast to help guide us through that panic that had set into the markets. So, Mark, are we past these liquidity concerns we saw a year ago, or have they been festering?
Listen, Julia, the way I look at where we were, you know, over the past 24 months, banks have been through several rounds of stress, and they've survived them all. So I think it's worthwhile reviewing where we were. You know, the first round started off with rapidly rising interest rates in the first part of 22, and that created large unrealized losses for banks. Because what happened then is banks had these large deposit inflows and they bought low-yielding securities because they wanted to increase their interest income by buying longer-dated securities that had higher yields. But as you know, as rates go up, bond prices go down, and lower bond prices pressure some of these banks' capital ratios. And that was a concern around the capital stability and viability of these banks. Then once we kind of got through the rapid rise in rates, we then entered a period of funding stress. And I call this round two. Here, we saw higher interest rates motivating depositors to move money from lower rate accounts into higher rate accounts. And that reshuffling of deposits kind of caused a lot of pressure for some of the smaller banks because we saw money move from the smaller community and regional banks into the larger money center and the larger regional banks. But this crisis too passed, helped by the regulators saying the fact that, you know, bank deposits were safe, even if the one or two of the banks were to wobble. And that really solidified confidence in the overall sector. And then post that, we ran into round three and kind of the last crisis in the past, and that was around the profitability. You know, banks, to retain and keep deposits, they had to pay up for deposits, and that caused them their interest income. And that's the difference between what they earn on loans and what they pay out on their deposits. That margin shrank a lot, and that caused bank profitability to suffer. You know, we're kind of post that now in a sense that the market understands where profitability is in this higher for longer environment. So really, that's where we were. So that leads up to the present day.
That's an incredible overview of really that three-pronged sort of pressure that banks had been experiencing for the past few years. And the good news, as you highlighted, is that those risks have mostly been managed with really substantial policy support. So let's move on to where we are now, as you said. I'd like to focus on probably the top area of ongoing risk that investors have seen filtering into the banking system, which is commercial real estate. As property values are marked down in the real estate segment, and as delinquency rates rise in certain portions there, Are you seeing meaningful areas of risk for banking sector health as a whole?
Right. You know, the next round of stress, and we're in it now, is commercial real estate. And the banks are big players in that. So stepping back, the commercial real estate funding market is around $4.5 trillion. The market is large. There are many types of players and many types of investors and many types of funding. The banks hold around 40% of the total funding of that total funding mix, whether it be, you know, owner-occupied properties, non-owner-occupied properties. And really, there are different classes of banks in that overall mix. You know, the money center and the larger regional banks hold the larger share of the bank financing segment. But really, it is the smaller community and smaller regional banks that are most exposed. And they're exposed because, as a percentage of their total assets and capital, they have a greater percentage of commercial real estate holdings. And they're the names that we're most concerned about, particularly if interest rates continue to remain elevated and property prices can fall. So, for example, in commercial real estate, our area of focus is office. And there, you know, we've seen property prices come down anywhere between 20 to 40%. And as we go through this higher rate environment, we could see further distressed sales, particularly because loans do mature. The average commercial real estate loan probably has a life of 5 to 10 years. So loans come up regularly. The good news for the commercial real estate market is the problem is known because loans mature on schedule. And over the next 4 years, there are $3 trillion worth of commercial real estate office loans that mature over the next while. And they need to be addressed, particularly if the value of the property is lower. So that's an area of concern. I think when I look at the banks don't want to own property. So they will work with borrowers to either ask borrowers to put in more capital to support loans, to reduce rates, or in some way to restructure the loan and to refinance it away from themselves. But really, it is the next few years will be critical for the banks to address these issues.
Those are such good points. And I just want to double click on one thing you said there, which is that the risks regarding commercial real estate exposure for these regional or smaller banks, the risk is understood, right? The risk is relatively well known. So there's one area of risk or murkiness that is less well known, and that is the economic environment. Now, overall economic growth in the U.S. has held up quite well, surprisingly well for some, but interest rates are high and loan delinquencies have started to rise in certain loan segments. How would you say that banks are coping with this environment in your view?
We've just come off the first quarter earnings reports for the large U.S. banks, and really all profitability is okay. You know, they recorded good numbers generally. You know, that what we saw in the fourth quarter, we saw banks allocate more their operating profit to building out their reserves. That was around, you know, 15% of their operating profit. In the first quarter, that fell a bit to 12% because the banks have largely provided for these upcoming risks that they expect to happen over time. That's overall, that's good news. There's help in the sector overall. I think also what's interesting is where we're seeing loan growth. You know, we are seeing growth, particularly in credit cards, where growth there could be around 10%. And that's not surprising given these credit cards are generally very profitable. Yields on a credit card loan can be up to 15%. I think banks are also finding that the consumer in the U.S. is a bright spot, in part because you think about there's around $10 trillion of stimulus in a $27 trillion economy. And that's from the monetary and the fiscal stimulus of the current and past administrations. So that's all generally very helpful for the U.S. banks. So much so that, you know, one of the larger banks mentioned the fact that the average consumer deposits are now 28% higher than they were pre-pandemic. And that's driven household net wealth, you know, to be at all-time highs at around $156 trillion. So the consumer in the U.S. is doing really well, and the banks are benefiting from that.
Wow. I mean, based on that quarterly data and based on the idea that loan loss provisioning, you know, that backup that banks are building for themselves, that seems to be pretty ample. So things seem to look okay. But I have to recall that a lot of banks saw a pretty newsworthy downgrade in their credit rating from Moody's last year. So I have to ask, when we zoom out from the quarterly data and think about banking sector health as a whole, do you think that banks are up to the task of managing through a potential economic downturn in the coming year?
Banking is a macroeconomic driven sector. They are well aware of managing through the cycles. To that extent, we believe that they have sufficiently provided for. Also, they still are profitable. So the first line of defense for a bank is profitability. And that at the moment is generally strong. So overall, that should also support their credit ratings. You know, credit ratings are generally, we think, stable, despite the fact that there may be one or two on negative outlooks. But overall, I think the story of last year of lower credit rating causing further flight and fear in the sector is largely a thing of 23 rather than 24.
So it looks like the where we are today faction of things looks relatively healthy. So with that, let's move into the last portion of our discussion for today, which is where the banking sector might be going. Now, although the timing is very uncertain, where the whole economy is likely to be going this year is into interest rate cuts territory. Now, the impact of interest rate cuts on the banking sector can be ambiguous. It's a balance between their interest margins, as you mentioned at the top, Mark, and the profitability on the loans that they're making, as well as loan growth, how many loans they're making, what that volume looks like. So what do directionally lower interest rates mean for the banking system, even if we don't know exactly when or to what degree they'll come down?
No, it's an interesting question, and I've thought about it. Generally, lower rates, particularly front-end rates, are benefit the banks because, think of it, banks make money by taking low-cost deposits at a low rate and then lending it onto the borrowers to loans at higher rates. So they make a margin on that differential interest rates. At the moment, that doesn't work because you think of it, you know, the three-month rate is around 5.4%. At which you may have to pay on your marginal CD or deposit rate versus the five-year rate on the benchmark is around 4.6%. So if you're borrowing at 5.4 and lending at, you know, 4.6, you're not making any money. So the current environment is not good for banks. So they need rates at the front end to come down to make money. Now, you know, my contention here is maybe more the fact that how is the yield curve going to shift and normalize? You know, if we go back to the 1960s and 70s, we could think that the fact that the yield curve could actually steepen at the long end, and that may actually cause banks to be more profitable by the long end steepening rather than the short end coming down. And you could argue maybe that the deficit could cause concerns about the long end going up, and also the fact that the economy starts to understand that the long-term mutual rate is actually higher than it thinks it is. So it actually causes a steepening of the curve rather than the front end coming down, the back end could go up. The net result is still good for banks, but overall, it could be bad news for the overall economy if we're going to shift in the upward and parallel curve.
Sure. The inversion of the U.S. Treasury curve has been an issue, not only because it's a traditional recession indicator, but exactly to your point, it really complicates the entire business model of how banks take deposits and then lend them back out. So thank you for talking through some of the mechanics on the back end there. I also want to cover another angle of monetary policy mechanics for a moment here that are backstopping the banking system. And this involves how the Fed manages its general banking reserves. This is actually really central to the Fed's work, and one portion of it is encapsulated in what we would call the Fed's Overnight Reverse Repo Facility, or RRP. Now, the RRP is seen as a gauge of excess reserves in the system, with more reserves pointing to more ample liquidity conditions or an easier operating environment for banks. The RRP has gotten a lot of attention recently because the use of this facility has been declining rapidly, potentially towards zero. And given those liquidity issues we talked about from 1 year ago, anything pointing to a more ambiguous liquidity environment for banks has caused some concern and debate. Mark, can I ask you to talk us through, at a high level, what the decline of RRP and shifts in liquidity here might mean for the sector?
Yeah, the RRP is interesting because it's a way for the money market funds to put excess deposits into the in, back to the Fed rather than into the banking system. You know, as the Fed reduces overall balance sheet, we think that the RRP balances will decline, which will also mean potential excess reserves for the banks will decline over time. You know, generally, it's a more functioning, healthy economy. And we expect reserves, the RRP reserves, maybe to decline by May and June of this year. And that's all, it's all beneficial to a better functioning overall economy, particularly as quantitative tightening is concluded as well at the same time. I think one thing to note also is the fact that the regulators also want to increase bank liquidity contingent funding. And at the moment, when a bank gets into trouble, the last form of resort for itself is to borrow the Fed, is to pledge collateral at the Fed window. There's stigma attached to that, because doing so would signal to your creditors and the other banks in the sector that you are at risk. And so the Fed wants to reduce the stigma of banks going to the discount window and allowing them, kind of forcing them, almost to programmatically borrow from the window over time to reduce the stigma. And that actually may improve the overall liquidity function of the economy and the backstop of the banks, assuming that stigma can be eliminated, which is debatable.
You're so right to raise that there's been such a massive amount of policy support, not only to the banks, but generally coming from the monetary policy apparatus these past few years. And when the headlines sometimes take the idea of lower liquidity as this very scary idea, it can actually mark a return to normalization, right? Returning to the way that things are supposed to function. So you're so right. It's such a good, poignant point that you're making. So thank you for raising that. Now, we've been talking about bank lending pretty much exclusively here. I want to make sure that we have a chance to zoom out. Are there any other dynamics prevailing in credit markets that investors should consider when they're thinking about bank sector health?
Yeah, the story we continue to read in the headlines is the competition between the banks and the non-bank sector. And it's interesting, you know, the Wall Street Journal reports today that, you know, the banking sector in 2008 had a kind of a total size around 12 trillion, which was equal to also the asset management, the private equity sector. Fast forward to today, the banking sector's, you know, total assets around 23 trillion. Meanwhile, private equity and the asset management sector is around 43 trillion. So it's grown much bigger, these non-bank financials. And what we're seeing is potentially these non-bank financials have a bigger footprint in the overall economy and lending to companies. So that's kind of curbing the universe of lending to some of these banks. And also the reason why, you know, corporate customers are going to some of these non-bank financials is simply because of lower rates, lower covenants, quicker turnaround. So I think the banks need also to figure out where they stand in this bigger competition between themselves and the non-bank financials.
Nothing like a high interest rate environment to prompt competition amongst capital providers, right? One last question for you in this section, Mark. It's an election year. And ever since the financial crisis, bank regulation has been a topic that candidates have to have a view on. Can you share your general expectations for what might happen under a second term for Biden or Trump?
Yeah, it's interesting. So maybe just starting off with Biden. We know that Biden likes regulations. So we expect the regulations that are proposals likely will be further enacted. And there we would see banks, the regional banks, large regional banks, be forced to issue more long-term debt for their bail-in purposes. So they become more important in the funding markets, and they'd have more resource to be bailed in, which would potentially create more financial stability longer term. There's also a proposal that will reduce the late payment fees on credit cards payments from, say, $40 to $8. And that could be impactful to some of the credit card companies. So that's a regulation there. And the other thing is an M&A for Biden. You know, we know that Biden administration continually looks at M&A across all sectors. And at the moment, there is one large deal going through in the credit card space that under the Biden administration may get more scrutiny. So that's all interesting. And then I also think that, you know, there is such thing as the Congressional Review Act, whereby, you know, the next government that came in could look back 60 legislative days and repeal any legislation that was enacted in the prior administration. And we think that Biden will make sure that these oldies rules are largely in place before, say, sometime in the summer, to prevent Trump, if he were to be elected, undoing his past regulatory agenda.
And speaking of former President Trump, what would you expect under a second term?
You know, Trump was not a fan of M&A either, so there could be less M&A in the bank space going forward. We also think on credit card space also, you know, Senator Josh Hawley, once put an 18% cap on credit card APRs. That would go through, it would impact the credit card industry an awful lot. And then my last thought around Trump and legislation in the Fed and banking is, I don't think Trump is a fan of Chairman Powell. He may force Powell to step down, and that could create a crisis of confidence in the Fed leadership.
That's such a comprehensive overview of how the stakes at play in the election extend beyond just regulation versus deregulation. It can even extend up into policy and policy appointments. So thank you very much for that overview. That brings us to our portfolio pause, a segment of the program where we share an investment idea. Mark, let's broaden this analytical perspective a bit to an allocation perspective. Normally, higher interest rates environments like the one that we're in would be conducive to banks, at least on the farther end of the yield curve, because they have better net interest margins. But this hasn't worked out to be the case in this cycle due to the inverted yield curve, particularly for small banks. So since you noted that the concerns from March of 2023 have been resolved, why are we still seeing some pressure on listed banks?
Yeah, there's almost a bifurcation in the market overall. So the large money center banks have done particularly well. They can access the markets. Their credit spreads are relatively tight to the overall corporate index. And on the other extreme are the regional banks, whose credit spreads have improved somewhat from the stresses of last March and April, but are still historically wide, around 60 basis points wide, and still present an opportunity for further outperformance as things start to normalize. But we feel that the normalization process may be many quarters and may be slightly delayed just given the current higher for longer interest rate backdrop. We think once the yield curve normalizes, in whatever shape it normalizes, at that point, the regional banks will continue to outperform. But at this point, given the rate backdrop, they will remain wide for the foreseeable future.
So we're looking at a banking system that's had a lot thrown at it these past few years. But from our conversation, I'm hearing themes like resilience and contingency planning and backstopping and an overall path toward policy normalization from one of incredible support these past few years. Mark, this has been an incredible discussion. Thank you so much for joining me and educating us, sharing some of your knowledge with us on this sector.
Thanks, Julia.
Coming up next, we're going to address the elephant left in the room, the health of U.S. commercial real estate. That's it for today. We'll be back next week for more Market Matters. In the meantime, please remember to give us a like, follow, or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have a question or topic of interest, reach out to us on LinkedIn. You can also follow our views at newyorklifeinvestments.com/global-markets. Until then, I'm Julia Herman. MacKay Shields is 100% owned by Nylam Holdings, which is wholly owned by New York Life Insurance Company. MacKay Shields is a sub-advisor for some mainstay funds and one of the New York Life Investments Company. Not all products and services provided by MacKay Shields may be available to all investors, limited by applicable laws and regulations in certain jurisdictions. Any opinions expressed are the views and opinions of certain investment professionals at MacKay Shields, which are subject to change without notice. No part of this material may be reproduced in any form or referred to in any other publication without express written permission of MacKay Shields. Past performance is no guarantee of future results, which will vary. All investments are subject to market risk and will fluctuate in value. Diversification cannot assure a profit or protect against a loss in a declining market. The opinions expressed are those of the Global Market Strategy Team, an investment team within New York Life Investment Management, LLC, and not necessarily those of other investment boutiques affiliated with New York Life Investments. This information should not be relied upon by the reader as research or investment advice regarding any strategy, and there is no guarantee that strategies we'll discuss will be effective. New York Life Investments is both a service mark and a common trade name of certain investment advisors affiliated with New York Life Insurance Company, New York, New York 10010.